A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 6, 1989, in the series Human Transformation, The Gospel and AA, entitled The Grace That Enables Us to View Ourselves Honestly. The scripture readings are Psalm 189 and John 4, verses 7 through 30. The texts for the sermon are Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24, and John 4, verse 29. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
We pick up again this morning the series, Human Transformation, the Gospel in AA. And we do so not because we are necessarily a publicist for this organization, but we do so because it is my conviction that there is not an organization or institution alive today that is doing as much to affect human transformation as AA. Behavior modification, but more than that, genuine, authentic, inward renewal. And when an organization is effective in human transformation, I want to know why, because after all, human transformation is what the church is all about. And then, of course, on reflection, reviewing the 12 steps of the AA program, one finds that what they have done is simply borrowed the insights of the gospel. And perhaps one can be comforted by the fact, well, after all, that's just the gospel. And it is the gospel. The insights about the human condition, about the grace of God, about forgiveness and Christian life that are in the gospel. 7 years ago, when I first did such a series, I entitled it, What the Church Has Forgotten, AA Remembers. And maybe there was a bit of a superiority feeling that, after all, AA may be effective, but they've borrowed it from the church. This is the gospel we have known. And maybe a word of admonition to the church. Get back to your own gospel. This time through, I've got to say, if there's one of the two organizations that deserves to feel a little bit superior, it's AA. Because to be sure, the insights of the 12 steps are derived from the gospel, but in terms of the practical application of these to human lives, we've got a lot to learn in the church. It's not just that AA has learned from us. It is that we have so much to learn from that institution. And if it is humbling to say it, then let it be said all the more loudly and clearly. It is high time in the church that we admit that there is an institution that is doing a better job with our truth than we are ourselves. And it's high time that we begin to learn how in the world it works so effectively for human transformation. Let me just review the territory we've covered so far, the first three steps. First of all, we confess our lives are out of control. We confess our lives are unmanageable. The alcoholic is the person who's fortunate enough to have his or her life run into a crisis in a rather public kind of way. This series of messages, I must never tire of repeating, is not for alcoholics, potential, present, or recovering. It's for us all. But the alcoholic happens to be one of those happy persons who runs into trouble so bad that it cannot be denied. Most of us can deny it most of our lives. Sort of keep your nose clean and don't screw up, and you can maintain the control of your life, and no one will know that it's you rather than God For we noted that control really is the issue. Either God is in control or I am in control. And if I am one who all too humanly insists on being in control, then we noted the paradox is that my autonomy leads to all forms of human bondage, whereas enslavement to God is the path to human freedom. It's just the way it is. And the alcoholic who runs into trouble is fortunate enough to be confronted with that truth so starkly that there can be no denial of it. But note the wisdom of AA. There's no condemnation, there's no judgmental attitude at this point. All a person has to do is say, I'm out of control. My life is unmanageable. There is no heavy-handed laying down of the law, speaking of the wrath of God, not even any talk about sin. There's no moralizing in the AA organization. The church has been afflicted with a brand of theology that I'd like to call puppy conditioning. In the church, we're not satisfied to point out the reality of the puddle, we push the poodle's nose in it. And we get very nervous about opening ourselves up very much to anybody who has not been clobbered by the law, as Luther said. Hammer them with the law until they plead for mercy and then present the gospel that they might find grace. And our Protestant understanding has been largely shaped by Luther's experience of sin and guilt and grace, which is a very profound understanding, but not the only one. And then there's step two. So I admit that my life is unmanageable. I come to say, possibly there is a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. We talk about a higher power. We don't talk about faith in or believing in, and there's no attempt to define that power. If you want that power to be the local telephone pole, let it be so, or the table, or the group, whatever it may be, is there something powerful, more powerful than you are, that can do for you possibly what you have admitted you cannot do for yourself? Would you be that open? Is it possible? Well, it's possible. That's enough. Well, in the church, that's not enough. Before you will be embraced warmly here, I'd like to hear a little bit about your conception of God. There is one true and eternal God, and there are all kinds of forfeits around the table. So let's be sure your understanding is correct. Let's dot the I's. Let's cross the T's. How about the Apostles' Creed? And can you affirm 127 questions of the Heidelberg Catechism? Are you familiar with the truths affirmed in the Belgic Confession, and are they your own? How about the Athanasian Creed and the Nicene Creed? Well, we could go on and on. The church gets nervous again that someone might get in on false pretenses. Someone might be talking about a power that's nothing more than a telephone pole, and we call it God. Well, AA is wise enough to know that God is not jealous for God's name. God can take care of God's self. What we're really so concerned about when we demand the I's be dotted and the T's be crossed is that the faith be confessed in a way that we confess it. That relieves our doubts and confirms our particular orientation. We get rather nervous when there's an orientation from another angle, because that might mean that our angle is not absolutely, totally, unconditionally the last word. AA doesn't really care. Are you willing to talk about a power? We could learn something there. And then the watershed, step three, we committed our lives. We were willing to turn over our lives, our wills, to God. That's the watershed. That's conversion. That's D-Day. That's the acknowledgement that whether it happens in a dramatic moment or whether it happens imperceptibly in the gradual turning to the light, that there is nonetheless the conscious, deliberate, intentional statement of commitment to God. Life turned over. Life out of my hands into the hands of God. And once again, we get to the watershed. We get to what we in Christian theology speak of as conversion. And there has not been one word about sin. There has been no moralizing. There has been no explicit language or implicit body language that has said to a person, "You're a dirty, stinking rotter. You've fallen on your face. You've failed. You've betrayed. You're in the wrong." We don't hear a word of it. And so maybe now someone's saying, what's what I thought? Just another humanistic organization that's soft on sin. Soft on sin? Not AA. Are you ready for step four? Are you ready for step four? You know how I could empty this church? By saying, "Get out your pencils, we're going to start doing step four right now." You beat it out of here like it was on fire. You ever see what step four is in the AA program? Take a searching, fearless, moral inventory. I have a little booklet here which is published by the Hazleton Clinic. It's called A New Fourth Step Guide. And let me just share a few things with you, because I want you to feel how honestly and directly the fourth step deals with the human situation without judging, without condemnation, without moralizing, with a kind of balance that recognizes that some people are so blind to themselves that they have to be clobbered over the head with a two before, and some people are so sensitive, having been in childhood, in family, and in church, dealt such a bad deck that their souls will always quiver before the reading of the law or the mention of sin. Oversensitive or overly dull, everyone's not the same, and yet we've sort of laid the same formula on everybody. But notice the nice balance and nuance of the instructions for the use of this guide. Step four marks the beginning of a new way of life. It says that today I will begin to make a realistic assessment of myself. Three attitudes are important: be searching, fearless, and moral. Are you searching? Are you really digging into your own self-awareness and describing your behavior as it really is? Are you fearless? It takes courage to face yourself in terms of what really has been going on in your life. Are you moral? Take a good look at the good, bad implications of your behavior. How does it size up with your own values? Take a searching, fearless, and moral inventory. But don't be moralistic. Oh, bless them. You know your behavior has good and bad aspects. That's a fact of life. Could we admit that in church? That that's not something that's true of those out there, but it's true of us here? Good and bad aspects to our lives? Could we admit that? Look at it. Own your own behavior. But don't punish yourself. Our goal is to know ourselves and to accept ourselves. Only then can we begin to change and to grow. This becomes a way of life based on the courage to be honest with ourselves. Well, this little booklet has 25 or 30 pages, but it doesn't have a lot of print. It's the kind of book I like. About four or five lines at the top of the page, and then it's blank. The only thing I could recommend would be a picture, and perhaps in living color, but otherwise I like it. Go through it in a hurry. No, you can't. Because at the top of the page is interesting stuff like, false pride. What we mean is excessive pride, being so thin-skinned that we have trouble admitting any human weakness at all. Another word for this kind of pride is grandiosity. Describe how your pride has kept you from looking at your own behavior. Explain. Or humility. Now that you are learning that it is safe to admit your powerlessness and unmanageability, do you find it easier just to be human? Being humble doesn't mean being weak. It means accepting ourselves, our strengths as well as our weaknesses. Do you know something now about what humility really means? Are you able to be less defensive, to enjoy the peace that comes from genuine humility? Explain. Well, it doesn't take long to read. It takes a good while to write. Fearless moral inventory. Searching, fearless moral inventory. The kind of thing I wouldn't dare suggest in the church. That's not fair. AA's not soft on the reality of the human condition. But AA has been so wise that it has been able to give to persons a feeling of acceptance, a ray of hope, the sense of support, and then, and only then, to call to genuine self-understanding, self-knowledge, in order that in the acceptance of oneself, there may begin the transformation of life. We are at step four, and in theological language, we are talking now about sanctification. We are talking now that one day at a time program whereby I live a life of ruthless honesty before God and before my neighbors and before myself. Well, the church could learn a lot from AA. I had a pastor who went through the program come to me and say, after many years in congregations, he said, "Dick, I have never experienced the honesty and the acceptance that I found in my first AA meeting in all of my life in the church." We are noted for many things, but not our honesty. And we're not noted for our honesty because we have not created an environment of grace and trust and non-judgment. The psalmist knew something about the God who knows us. That magnificent 139th Psalm leaves us no place in heaven or hell in the extent of the cosmos where God is not to be found and heard and encountered. No hiding place, no place to flee. The wings of the morning won't do it. Thou, God, knowest me altogether. What a scary thing. But not a scary thing. Somehow it's possible for that kind of total honesty to be experienced without fear, without with Adam hiding in the bushes, but standing full square in the presence of the truth, owning one's story. The only thing that makes it possible, of course, as an environment of grace, to know God as the psalmist knew God, to know that God is no marshmallow, no pushover, that God is not mocked, that God knows all to the depths, that there is no possibility of some dark cranny in some corner where one may crouch, but to know nonetheless that before God one can be oneself in the full spectrum of one's being. The Old Testament is so beautiful because it's so honest. It has a kind of rugged honesty about it. The psalmist, after speaking about this mysterious and magnificent omniscience of God, thinks about those who are obstructing God's purpose and plan, and he so identifies with the plan and the purpose of God that he feels rage rising within him. And without saying that as a child of God he cannot feel angry or he cannot allow such emotions out, he says, Why dost thou not kill them who oppose thee? My heart rages against them. Why don't you? And in the moment, presence of God, search me and try me and know my heart and see if there be any wicked way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. Ah, that's so real. That's so genuine. It's so painful. It's so liberating. It's so much like God, full of grace. Somehow or other, Jesus, in word and deed, created that environment of grace where a woman from Samaria undressed in front of him, making the usual detours, wanting to talk about doctrine and theology and worship. Oh, you must be a prophet. Should we worship here or there? Let's get off the subject, Lord, because you're getting too close. But there must have been something about Jesus. Made her know, held her with a magnetism that embraced her in a larger grace that was able to engage her at the very core of her being until she went home and said, come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done. That's painful. That's liberating. That's wonderful. You know, to be able to say before the face of God, have thine own way, Lord, have thine own way. Search me and try me, Master, today. Mold me and make me after thy will. While I am waiting, yield to thee. That's the bondage that is perfect freedom. That's the grace that enables us to view ourselves honestly.